Can everyone hear me okay? It's really strange to hear my own voice. Let me get used to it for just a second. Okay, so thank you all for coming to the Agnaw West Landmark Van Dorn Instrumentation Advisory Group meeting. We have a pretty packed schedule today, so we're going to go ahead and get started.
That's the face that you'll be seeing in the future, and I've provided his email address if anybody wants to contact him as well. He is based at the Howard Hughes Corporation in Dallas, Texas, so unfortunately he's not here all the time, but he does come into Alexandria at least once a month, and probably more so as the replanting efforts get underway. So many of you remember that the city and you were involved in the Landmark Van Dorn plan back in about 10 years ago, and it resulted in a plan recommendation for property that includes the Landmark Mall. This is just a snapshot from the street framework that was adopted as part of the plan. And Howard Hughes came in after this process. Initially, it was a company called General Growth Properties that owned the mall, along with Sears and Macy's. And General Growth, shortly after the adoption of this plan, went into bankruptcy. I don't think they were related, but there was a bankruptcy soon after that. And out of that bankruptcy proceeding, there were two new companies created. One was an extension of General Growth Properties that owned the operating assets of the original company. And then a new company called Howard Hughes that was created to take on the development properties that had been part of the General Growth portfolio. And Landmark Mall, of course, was one of those. And so Howard Hughes was operating the mall for a number of years and began trying to work on plans for redevelopment. This is the overall development parameters that are contained within the small area plan. Roughly 5 million square feet of mixed use development that potentially could be approved for the mall site. This is an important slide because, as with many regional malls that were developed in the 70s and 80s, the anchor stores were landowners of the mall projects along with development companies. And in this case, the landmark property was originally owned by Sears up at the area toward 395 and Duke Street. General Growth and then Howard Hughes owned the sort of the main part of the mall, and then Macy's owned its store and land related to it. And as part of the creation of the mall, there was a reciprocal easement agreement that was recorded, and each of these three parties essentially has a veto on any change to the rest of the mall. So for Howard Hughes to make any changes, they had to get consent from Sears and from Macy's, and it applies to Sears and Macy's as well. One of the reasons why nothing has happened at Landmark over these years since the plan was adopted is that Sears and Macy's have been going through a lot of transitions themselves, and for a number of years weren't really sure what they wanted to be or what they wanted to do with these assets. So even though Howard Hughes has had continuing conversations with these other landowners, it's taken quite a while to get to some arrangement that would allow for the implementation of a redevelopment plan. In 2013 originally, and then revised in 2015, Howard Hughes was able to work with those other mall owners and come up with an interim development plan that would have developed essentially the walk-around part of the mall, exclusive of the Sears and Macy's store. Many of you were involved in the review of those plans, and they remain the pending approvals on the site as of today. However, a couple of important changes have occurred. One is about a year ago, I think, maybe a little bit more, Howard Hughes was able to purchase the Macy's property, so they now own essentially two-thirds of the mall site. The other thing that happened is that Sears Roebuck moved the land assets of its company into a new real estate investment trust called Seritage. That was the name that you saw on the earlier slide. And Seritage has sort of a newer mission. It's not really based upon continuing to operate the Sears stores. It's about getting revenue from the use and redevelopment of the land. So Howard Hughes and Seritage have been in conversations for a number of months to work together for a implementation of a complete redevelopment plan of the entire mall. And they're coming very close to an agreement on that, and we've been meeting with city staff over the last couple of months to get ready to start the planning process. And that's really why I'm here tonight, is to give you that update and that expectation that we will be moving forward with a update of the plan for Landmark Mall. What's happening currently is, as most of you know, the mall was closed except for Sears, I guess about a year ago now, so that it's completely closed for the public. There was a request from the Carpenter's Shelter basically almost a year ago, saying that they need a temporary space to occupy while their existing shelter on Patrick Street, Andrew Street, is demolished and their new shelter with the affordable housing component is constructed. And so Harry Hughes felt that that was an important contribution that they could make to the community by agreeing to have Carpenter Shelter move in to the empty Macy's store. And for the last several months, Carpenter Shelter has been fitting out, I think it's the second floor of the old Macy's store, so it can be occupied as a shelter and a family shelter, a day shelter. The programs that they essentially have in Old Town today will temporarily move. I believe it's scheduled to move in June, is my understanding. There is a limitation on their occupancy at Landmark Mall of no more than 2 years, because First of all, they want to get back to their new location, but importantly, we, and this was discussed in concert with the city staff, we didn't want to delay the possibility of redevelopment of Landmark Mall. And so we knew it would be about 2 years to get through the planning process and the special use permits and the site plans. And so this should line up very well that when Carpenter Shelter is able to move back into its permanent facility, we'll be able to tear down the Macy's store and start that redevelopment. Although we haven't kicked off the formal replanning process, we have gone forward with some engineering studies, specifically working with Erin and her staff on sewer capacity to make sure that as the city is doing its plans and Landmark is doing its plans for redevelopment, that there is sufficient capacity in the sewer system to absorb that. So we've been working together on that. We've also begun traffic counts because we'll have to do a new updated traffic study. And as many of you know, once school's out, you can't get accurate traffic studies. So we advanced that work to make sure that it was done before the summer. And you may see some folks out with counters over the next couple of weeks. And then, as I mentioned, there's coordination with Seritage, essentially to put together a joint venture agreement that would allow the redevelopment of the entire 50-some acres to go forward as one single project. And I spoke with Mark Polnesh yesterday afternoon, and he said that those conversations are going very well. And we do hope to be able to more formally kick off this planning effort, hopefully during the summertime. Is our expectation now. So the next steps, once we get that worked out with Seritage, is to begin making specific proposals to the community and to the city staff for any minor changes that we think would be necessary to the adopted Landmark plan. Don't have any expectation that there would be any increase in the amount of development that's already in the plan. We expect that there may be some adjustments to the relative amounts of different uses, but that's evolving and we'll be able to come back to you with more information about that. Obviously, there's an intensive period of staff analysis as we come forward with these ideas, and we expect that the community engagement part, the very important part, would begin next fall as we move forward toward hearings of the Planning Commission and City Council on first updating the plan and then working on special use permits. So that's the current status, and there's my contact information, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions that you might have. Yes, ma'am. Although that's still part of the conversation, my understanding is that Seritage does want, the question was, do we expect that Seritage will continue to own some of the land in Landmark? And although it's under discussion, I think that their desire is to stay as part of the redevelopment in some sort of an ownership position. Although I think Howard Hughes is intending to be the overall developer of the entire site. Any other questions? Okay. Yes, sir.
Could you just speak a little bit more, Jonathan, to the change in use? And is it fair to say you're looking at increasing the residential component at the expense of the other?
Yeah, it's all in play at the moment in terms of what we're going to propose, and then obviously we'll need to get feedback from you all and the staff. But I would guess that the earlier program that included a minimum of 2.5 million square feet of office. Many of you know there just isn't much demand for office these days, so we may be asking for some flexibility on that. But we'll come forward with a more integrated package of uses that we think would be fiscally to the advantage of the city. Sir?
The other question is really about transportation. The plan in 2013 had certain improvements to access that the developer was going to make. Now that you've got both the Macy's and the, you know, soon to be hopefully joint venture with Seritage, do you anticipate being able to do a lot more with transportation to and from that site to make it completely multimodal?
Yeah, there are two things that we're focused on in the planning efforts at the moment. One is, obviously we're committed to facilitating the BRT, the enhanced transit corridor. And the other is that one of the challenges to the landmark site is it's kind of isolated, and there aren't many ways of getting in and out from Van Dorn and from Duke. And obviously there won't be on 395, but we're trying to explore ways to make it a little bit more connected to the rest of the city. Okay, thanks very much.
Screaming into this thing or not. I'm Sarah Woodworth. I'm a principal at WZHA, a real estate consulting firm headquartered in Annapolis, Maryland. And I've worked with the city of Alexandria for over a decade in doing developer contribution analysis and other economic analysis for specific projects. And what we thought we would do, since you're the implementation advisory group, is to really run through some of the basics of development economics and some the basics of developer considerations, contributions, and things that we need to consider. So right now, it's really just getting everybody up on the learning curve. Some of this may be totally obvious to you. Other people may, it may be informative. So hopefully we're hoping it is informative. The agenda, I'm hoping to speak for 15 minutes. This is gonna require that I move through this and be direct and targeted. First, just talking about development economics and important principles as it relates to development economics. The development contribution process, how we think about it, and considerations that we need to take think through when we try to actually project the potential contributions from private developers over time, and then key takeaways. So development economics, this is a no-brainer. Developers don't do development to lose money. They need to cover their costs and make an adequate return on investment. And because real estate is essentially a relatively illiquid asset, you can't just flip it easily. It's a mid to long-term hold. It's a relatively high-risk investment prospect as compared to other investment vehicles like the stock market. So, development costs. You probably all recognize that site acquisition, site work, like, you know, getting the site flat, construction costs, parking costs, soft costs. Soft costs include things like architecture and engineering, legal, marketing, and et cetera. And financing costs all contribute to the total cost of a development project. There are two things I want to say. It does not cost $100 a square foot to do a development project in Alexandria, Virginia. It costs more like $300 or closer to $300. It's an expensive venture. The second thing I want to point out is that construction costs and soft costs for the same product, let's say we're talking about a five-story apartment building, are pretty much going to be about the same across the city. So 70% of your cost is going to be the same regardless of whether you're in a low rent or a high rent district. So you sort of have some fixed costs. And by the way, construction costs right now are escalating very, very rapidly. That's a concern throughout the, mostly on the coasts of this country. Net operating income is simply the checkbook of a project. It says, what can I get in income, including rental income, parking, if you have parking fees, and other fees like storage, pet fees, late fees. What do I get in income and subtract out operating expenses? Operating expenses include things like management, maintenance, real estate taxes. Operating expenses for the same product in the city, I would suspect, are fairly similar across the entire city. When you subtract the operating expenses from income, you get net operating income. it does not incorporate any debt service. This is truly the performance of the real estate project. Now, what happens is prospective investors or developers look at sites and say, would this be worth my while as an investor? Can I make my cost back in an adequate rate of return? There are many ways to measure a return. It can get pretty complicated. But the basic back of the envelope methodology is really simple. And it really tests just simply, does this real estate project work? And that's what we call an investment yield, which is simply net operating income, which is just how much income does it generate in a given year, divided by development cost. And it has to satisfy a certain investment hurdle. The investment hurdle is defined by the developer. It isn't a canned number that everyone uses. It's basically a function of something called a capitalization rate for the given type of land use, plus what they consider to be risk. And for this scenario, I'm going to assume a base case investment threshold of about 6%. So that net operating income divided by development costs should be at least 6% for me to even pursue the idea of investing in a given area. And given what a 60-unit development project, which was showed you the development cost, about $18.6 million cost, net operating income, I assumed a rent of $2,125 on average per month, you can see that this particular base case scenario generates an investment yield of 6.1%. I said my hurdle was 6% as an investor, so I might pursue, I might continue to do due diligence on this project, refine my development cost, figure out if my rent is really $2,125, but then get deeper and deeper into it. If that was an investment hurdle considerably lower than 6%, I'd either change the product that I was thinking about developing, I'd move to a different area of the city, or I wouldn't invest in the city at all. But pretty basic first cuts at real estate. So important principles. It seems to me that those are essentially the same product. It's about a five-story apartment building. One is the Belle Prix Apartments of Braddock. The other one is the Madera Tempo Apartments here in Eisenhower West, Lambert Red Door. Fact is, for that same product, the difference in rent is between 7% and 14%, with the Braddock property generating a rent premium. And that has to do with a lot of things. Amenities, walkability, proximity to the metro. But the idea is the same product can have a very different rent depending upon where you are in the city. So if in fact I projected a rent of $2,125 per month on average per apartment, and in fact rent was 5% lower, in other words, I missed it, my investment hurdle isn't met. Your ability to project rent is pretty much highly correlated with your ability to make money in real estate. That and managing construction costs. So anyway, my point here is that's a 5% difference, the hurdle is not met. So very sensitive to rent. And that's something that we're doing as part of our developer contributions analysis, is really trying to project realistically where will the rent be in the near term, midterm, and long term. The other thing is economics are super, super sensitive to perceptions of risk, market risk. And that has a lot to do with where developers or investors feel that an area is in its evolution. Is it about to take off? Is it not going to take off for another 5 years? Is it already taken off and it's tapped out? That will all go into their understanding about market risk. If I assume, at first I said my threshold was 6%, but I'm now in an area that says, you know what, I'm not sure this place is ready yet. I'm not clear that we're going to have the same kind of investment that I want to see happen. I don't see a lot of projects like the one I want to invest in already built and it's successful, so I'm a pioneer. I might up my risk and make my investment threshold 6.5%. So one of the things we also have to think about when we're thinking about the economics of development is where really is that risk threshold realistically so that we can actually project the economics of redevelopment in our area. Market drivers, the regional economy and capital markets are huge. We are in one of the strongest real estate markets in the country. I think Alexandria is really well positioned there. Critical mass or successful catalyst projects. I can't overemphasize, I've been doing this for a while now, how money follows money in real estate. They're like lemmings. The minute there are about three or four successful projects in a given neighborhood, all of a sudden, they're all jumping in. And I'm sure you have seen that in different parts of this city and in the metro area. But once a certain critical mass or a series of catalyst projects really, really communicate to the investment community that this area is gonna grow in value, all of a sudden money will flow. And I have to say, it's almost like a tipping point. It's hard to know when it happens, but it definitely happens. And then transit investment in a submarket is really important to value and rent. We know that Metro typically generates a 10 to 15% premium on rent within for sites within walking distance. And we're also knowing now more and more that bike and ped connectivity adds real value to rent and rent premiums. The public sector's influence on market. The city cannot create market. Cities have tried. They've built convention centers, they've built ballparks, they've done all kinds of things to try to create market. And I would suggest to you, not every time have they been successful. In fact, public sector can influence market. And there are, in my mind, and maybe others have more to this list, but the four biggies are a plan. Developers and investors want to have a public policy document that clearly states how the city or the county wants to see a planning a place evolve. Regulation is also important. As much as developers gripe about our regulations, the fact is they're probably the biggest insurance policy they've got, because what it does is it ensures consistency and certain level of quality over time. I remember Braddock having a conversation like this about real estate economics and having a bunch of developers tell me we cannot afford underground parking. We can't do underground parking. I would suggest to you now that they have had generated more value in their real estate because the city actually supported an underground parking regulation, and now they're a walkable place and values, as you know, and investment has accelerated in Braddock. Transit investment is one of the major things that the public sector can do. That's typically a city and region and national funding formula. We know we have Metro in Eisenhower West and Landmark Van Dorn, and we also know that the Eisenhower West Transit Way is planned. Those are very important. What they are is they're also fixed assets. There's no, you know, they're important, valuable contributions to the backbone, essentially, of a real estate market. And then the private sector partner, the city can partner with the private sector to facilitate investment. So developer contributions, what are they and why do we do it? Well, what we need to do is understand the economic implications of the rezoning, like you're contemplating in your plan, to determine the equitable public-private funding of community benefits. And we also use the developer contribution analysis. Given the limits of private funding and public funding, how do we actually put together a funding plan to implement the plan? So really basic outline of the developer contribution concept is assuming there is endless market. I'm going to use an example where there's a property owner developer that has an existing site that can handle 15 dwelling units, and the land value per dwelling unit is $40,000, which means today the land is worth $600,000. All of a sudden we do a plan, we up the rezoning, there's market enough to fill it, we say now you can build 55 units on your piece of land. Now that land is worth $2.2 million. So by the stroke of a pen, that landowner has received $1.6 million of value. Our premise on developer contributions is we as the community need to participate in that upside in terms of community amenities and infrastructure. So we want to participate in that enhanced value. Now, important considerations. This seems really basic, but you can't believe how many communities aren't really recognize this. First of all, if there's no market for anything above 15 units, even though I zone it for 55, the owner has not gotten any near-term real value increase because you can only support 15 units. Montgomery County has gone and rezoned all of its metro stations and upzoned them, and they can't figure out why there isn't more value. Some of those metro stations don't have the market for the zoning envelope that they have prescribed. So you have to have enough market to actually fill up the envelope to have value realized in the near term. The second thing I want to talk about is I'm going to use a strip shopping center. There is a perception that just because we increase density, we increase value. And what happens with strip shopping centers is here I've got a property owner that has an existing shopping center that's worth $1 million in land value. Even though it's a 0.25 FAR, in other words, very low, lots of surface parking, and we say, no, we're going to give you 30 dwelling units on top of that. You're going to be able to intensify that land use. In fact, if 30 dwelling units and they only have $25,000 per unit land value, they're only getting $750,000 with the rezoning, I'm not going to redevelop my shopping center. And this happens in a lot of places. People think shopping centers should be redeveloped because they look like they're not an efficient use of land. But in fact, they're incredibly productive financially sometimes. And so we really have to look at the economics of redevelopment. I'm not sure why that sometimes happens. Another important consideration is for us to increase density. Sometimes we have other regulations that say we have to have underground parking. And that may be an additional cost. And the question is, can the rents support the additional cost of underground parking? So in this scenario, which was our old scenario, we had $600,000 worth of value, but to get to the 55 units, I have to have a $35,000 parking space. So in fact, I've actually not increased value with that increased density because there are additional costs associated with it. So I'm not going to redevelop the site. So we're thinking about this when we're doing our redevelopment analyses and developer contribution analyses. And then finally, in the case of Eisenhower West and Landmark Van Dorn, there are additional costs, like we want to see some land assembly happen with roads, interior roads. That's also an additional cost. I mean, we're taking that into consideration as part of our developer contribution analysis. So key takeaways, markets are super local, which means rent is super local, but markets evolve. Just because a rent may be $2,000 a month today, 5 years from now, depending upon how things evolve, that rent could be significantly higher. Catalytic projects do improve investment prospects. I think the Cameron Park project like this, Landmark's redevelopment, could be potentially really, really valuable to the rest of this area because they're strong projects. Early projects can have little capacity for developer contributions. Just because we have zoning does not necessarily mean value will be realized, is the point here. However, developer contributions could evolve in the mid to long term. And then planning must consider the short, middle, and long term. When we think about funding the implementation of our plan, there will be different funding strategies depending upon where we are on the evolution of the area from a market and economic standpoint. So that's the end of the economic briefing. Any questions? Yeah?
Does the city's inability to back off of developer contributions, because we're very inflexible in voluntary contributions, which aren't, they're prescribed, does that have any effect on discouraging developers from coming into this market?
You said the city has a developer contribution policy that is fairly strict, that they're always asking for developer contributions, and that does that discourage investment in this market? And I think the purpose of the analysis that we're now doing for the Eisenhower West Landmark Van Dorn plan is to really get those contributions sensitive to the true economics of this area. And my experience with the city is we really have been trying to do that, because the last thing we want to do is disincent investment. At the same time, we want to be sure it's a fair public, an equitable public-private deal. But my experience so far has not been that that the developer contributions are so high that people just walk. I mean, there are a lot of other areas in this metro region that exact other very high developer contributions, just in a different form.
Now, second question. Does the length of time it takes to get through our development processes, which can be 2 years, 3 years, have anything to do with discouraging developers knowing that they're sitting on assets that can't produce income?
So the question was, does the length of our approval process discourage investment? Sort of a simple way, right? I mean, the approval process, the longer it is, the more money it costs. Notice my soft costs, I use 20%. If you're in Corpus Christi, that could be like 12%. So I do think that from my experience here, that a lot of the developers in the Washington metro area build into their I don't think there are many surprises, you know what I mean? That they build into their pro formas a fairly lengthy entitlement process. Simply because this is it's all the communities in the metro area are fairly intent on making sure that they get the level of quality of development that their public policy, you know, suggests and the community expects. But certainly, one of the things the public sector can do is help to facilitate private investment. No question, in many communities, they have expedited approval processes for exactly that reason, to actually shorten the time frame, reduce cost, and they think of that as an incentive. So, thanks.
So following up on Mindy's first question, the city has several very well...
It's really hard. Yeah.
The city has some fairly well-established policies that guide developer contributions and that are well-known by the development community, and some of them come down to things like, you know, $1.92 a square foot, or there's very specific numbers. Are you implying that through the exercise for Eisenhower West Landmark Van Dorn that those numbers might be different for this particular neighborhood? And I'm thinking about affordable housing, for example. Would we have a different standard in this neighborhood than in the rest of the city?
As for the affordable housing, the analysis that my company is performing is the affordable housing is a given, I think. And so what we're looking at is the other developer contributions towards community benefits, infrastructure, amenities. And in that case, it is, I mean, I worked on the Landmark Van Dorn, the John plan. And you know, the idea was, well, what are we going to get in developer contributions in the first phase? And we call it a catalytic phase, because I couldn't find that the economics would support a significant developer contribution. So that what we're doing is we're trying to phase it and understand really where in the short, middle, and long term should those developer contributions be. But as for the affordable housing, I think that's a given public policy.
So we're still talking about multiple layers.
I think so. And Jeff, what I'm working on is the developer contributions towards infrastructure, amenities, et cetera. So I guess the answer, she said, so we're talking about different layers, and the answer is yes. Any other questions? Okay, thanks.
Okay, Paul, you're up. And then we'll have Aaron and then Nathan.
I would. Sorry.
Well, did you stand on the other side?
Yeah, I think that would be better. Good evening. My name is Hua Chen. I'm with the Office of Environmental Quality, DNES, at the city. Today, I'd like to give you an update on our air quality analysis study that we've been doing for the small area plan here. And just to recap, in the last two meetings, I came here and give you the update on this project, and the initial objective was to assess the potential air quality impacts from the Covanta and the Virginia paving plans on future high-rise buildings located in the Van Dorn Metro Center as part of the SNR West Moore Area Plan. And the preliminary results that I reported to you in the last meeting was that no air quality issue was associated with the Covanta or Virginia paving operations under the present land use. So we're good for that. There was no issue at all. And we also, I also reported to you that additional money was needed for the proposed buildings for the Van Dorn Metro Center that are above 120 feet. And the oxides of nitrogen emission limit from Covanta was actually the main concern at the time. And just to show you, this is the Metro Center that we're doing the work on at the time. Van Dorn Metro Center, the buildings in blue. And concurrent to that, and separate from our modeling exercise, Covanta has to submit a plan to the Virginia DEQ in response to new regulatory requirements to reduce its nitrogen oxide emissions using some what they call a reasonably available control technology. And basically, this includes the use of their existing technology where they inject ammonia into the hot gases to convert nitrogen oxide back to nitrogen and oxygen. And also they have a proprietary low, they call it low NOx technology that they develop in-house. And by the combination of the two, they will be able to reduce the NOx emissions by 46%, which is very significant. So basically, they are proposing to the Virginia DEQ that instead of the present limit of 205 parts per million nitrogen oxide emissions in the stack gas, they are willing to live with 110 in the next permit. So Virginia DEQ is now reviewing the application, and they're doing it for both Covanta at Alexandria and also the Covanta plant in Fairfax County as well. So we expect that probably during the fall there will be a draft permit limit coming out for public comment, and so we keep in touch, and as soon as that happens, we'll let all of you know. So that's a chance for the city to comment on that. So after the last meeting, we went on with the what we call the phase two, which is the current modeling effort, where we made a concerted decision to expand the modeling into all proposed buildings in the Eisenhower West, but also the landmark and Van Dorn small area plans as well. And here's the Van Dorn Metro Center, right, that which we study in our preliminary study, but now we include everything, including this area and this area as well. And when we do that modeling, we assume new lower NOx permit limit for Covanta, and we do the modeling both for both Covanta only, meaning only Covanta plants operating, and also a scenario where combined Covanta Virginia paving scenario. And today I'm going to present to you the results of our Covanta only operations. see the woman.
Yeah.
Okay, so the major takeaway for the governmental scenario, the good news is that there are only six tall buildings immediately adjacent to Coventa may pose air quality issues if built to maximum height in plants, in the small area plant. And the good news is that all but one, only one building has to reduces height outside of the approved height in the small area plan. And these are the six buildings that we identified. The one with the red fonts. And this one is the one that has to reduce the height outside of the small area plan. So that's what we think. It is a very good news that with the reduced NOx limit, you know, the impact on the small area plan would be rather limited compared to the present limit. So, and just to show you, so after we identify those heights, we use those heights and plug it into our modeling program and to see whether it meets all of the other, you know, components of the air quality standards. And as you can see in this column here, all of them pass the standards, so there's no issue at all. So that's very good news. So the next step for us is to refine the modeling for the combined Coventa and Virginia paving scenario to be, you know, up to now the focus was on the Coventa and now we're putting focus on Virginia paving because there's some Virginia paving operates a kind of on an it's not a continuous process where they operate like Coventa, they operate day in, day out, 24 hours a day, and maximum capacity. But which Virginia paving is different because of the SUP conditions as well. Like, they have the capacity, for instance, to produce 5 million tons a year. But our SUP conditions say you can only produce maximum 980,000 tons. And last year, they produce 230,000 tons, which is only about 5%, a little bit 5% of the capacity that they're capable of. And in terms of operating hours, also they don't operate 24 hours a day. They operate probably about 8-9 hours a day on average. So that makes the modeling more complicated. And we want to be, on the one hand, to be conservative, to protect public health, but we don't want to be excessively conservative, that become unrealistic. So that's why it takes some time to come up with a scenario that is both conservative and realistic as well at the same time. So we next meeting we will come back and tell you about the results of the modeling exercise. I believe that'll be in September, actually. Thank you. And please, if you have any questions, I'd be pleased to answer. Yes, hi, Jessica. So
this may have already been addressed, but have you looked into like any type of noise concerns from these two industrial type uses?
A noise concern, you say? Mm-hmm. You know, up to now, we haven't had any complaints, like resident complaints about noise. So odor used to be more of an issue from pushing the paving.
Okay, yeah.
But noise, we never, I hardly hear any complaints about noise. And for the last year, for instance, we don't have any complaint at all from Virginia Building. So they've been doing a very good job following SUP conditions, you know, to the point. And they've been very, very good at that. So, any more questions? Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Erin Dennis Carver. I'm an engineer with the Sanitary Infrastructure Division and Department of Transportation and Environmental Services, and I'm just going to be giving an update on where we are on our sewer study. And I'm just going to start with some of the background that you have seen before, but when we talk about the sewer study, we're talking about analyzing the trunk sewers that serve the plan area. And so there are four trunk sewers under consideration. Three of them are actually owned by Fairfax County, and that is because this plan area was, you know, previously part of Fairfax County that the city had annexed. So we have two sewers along Backlip Run, which we call the North and South Backlip Run sewers, and then two sewers that we call the Holmes Run sewers, one owned by Fairfax County and one by Alice Renew. And as part of this sewer analysis, we are looking at, you know, existing flow conditions and then the impacts of future growth on sewer capacity. Important to note that city, we already have a means of dealing with capacity issues in our local city-owned sewers, and that's done through the DSP process. So the sewers that we're talking about, they are shown, these orange, yellowish sewers, these are our city collector sewers. We have about 240 miles of them in the city. And then we have the interceptor sewers. These are the Fairfax County backlick sewers. And so these, all of these sewers, it's important to note, serve both the city and Fairfax County. So both jurisdictions use these sewers. So for these backlick run sewers, they extend out into Fairfax County. The flows come through and then enter this other green sewer, also owned by Fairfax County, that goes all the way up to like the northwest city-county line. And they come into this sewer, and then this sewer then flows into the Alice Renew trunk sewer, shown here, and then to the Alice Renew wastewater treatment facility. And it's important to note, so here is the Alice Renew wastewater treatment facility, and flow comes in from the city through one of four interceptor sewers. And it's important to note that this area, this is the Holmes Run trunk sewer, and serves the majority of the city. So when we're looking at sewer capacity in these sewers, we're not just considering the Eisenhower West Landmark Van Dorn plans. We are looking at Beauregard, we are looking at Eisenhower East, all of these flows that contribute to the sewer system. And when we talk about potential future improvements, you know, it's something, it's not just from development here, it's really, we're looking at the impacts from all of this. So back in February, you know, we were in the process of calibrating the model. And model calibration is important to be able to replicate what happens today so we can, you know, see what we think will happen in the future. So that calibration has been done and the model runs have been completed. In addition, we have identified where our capacity constraints are in the system, and we do have some. And working jointly with Alex Renew and Fairfax County, have come up with some infrastructure improvements that will be able to serve future growth. And we're kind of summarizing all of this information into a report now. So good news is when we look at the backlick run sewers that go through the plan area, we find that when we're looking at really 2040 and beyond, there is sufficient capacity in those sewers today to serve redevelopment, which is good news. And that includes, you know, both the plan area flows and Fairfax County's projected flows that come into those sewers. When we look at the Holmes Run sewers, both Fairfax's and the Alice Renew lines, we do see some capacity issues in those sewers. And this is important because when you don't have capacity in the sewer, flows fill up in the pipe and they have to go somewhere, and it is kind of the path of least resistance, which usually ends up in people's basements. So sewer capacity is an important issue. It's an important infrastructure issue. And we do see capacity issues that are located between really where those flows come in from Fairfax County all the way, about a 2 mile reach all the way down to Duke Street. So working together with Alice Renew and Fairfax County, we've come up with what we think are solutions that will solve these capacity issues. And I'll talk about a little bit about what those are and where those are, but we're really looking at both of the sewers, and what we're recommending and what our consultant is recommending is to do sewer lining on the Alex Renew Holmes Run sewer between the city county line all the way down to Van Dorn. And what sewer lining, for those of you who don't know, is an efficient solution, not just for basically where you insert a pipe within a pipe. You put in a liner, you go in through the manhole, so there isn't, you don't have to do digging and replacement of pipe. And you're able to insert a liner, it adheres to the hose pipe, and it not only does it renew the sewer, because sewers degrade over time, it's important to note that these sewers were put in the 1950s, but it also provides a smoother surface, so you actually can push more flow through. And then for the lower Holmes Run sewer, we're looking at sewer replacement. Basically, upside, the current pipe doesn't have capacity, so it's upsizing of that existing pipe to provide the capacity needed. And so where this is located, so here along this blue sewer is where sewer lining is recommended. Once again, this is a trenchless installation. And it's about 45,000 feet of sewer. For the Fairfax County line, it recommends sewer upsizing. So essentially, replacing the existing pipe with larger pipe. So will likely involve, and we're still looking at kind of what types of sewer installation technologies, but in terms of disruption, you know, there's an existing sewer, there's an existing easement, you know, work being done within that existing easement. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them as I'm going through. So I guess what everyone was interested in is how much will this cost? So it's important to note that we haven't started any design. At this point, we are, you know, at the planning stage, and we look at cost. It's what's called an order of magnitude cost. And what that means is it's a cost estimate without any actual design have taken place. So when we come up with those costs, you know, how do we come up with these costs? We look at other projects that, you know, are similar in size and scope. We look to see how much those projects cost. We escalate those to today's dollars. And so that's what we have done to come up with this cost estimate. So, you know, in terms of confidence, you know, you're looking at kind of an order of magnitude, minus 30 to plus 50%. And it's important to note, as I said earlier, this is a very large sewership. And you know, this isn't just a city issue. This is a city and a Fairfax County issue. So, you know, when we're talking about future infrastructure improvements, it's sharing those costs between the two jurisdictions. And you know, exactly how much is the city versus how much is the county, you know, we're not there yet. That's something that we have to work out. Yes, Beth?
Just wondering, what is Fairfax County's incentive to contribute to this cost, since we're talking about serving Alexandria development?
Well, so the question is, you know, what is Fairfax County's incentive to participate in this cost sharing? And really, it's not just that there's additional development for Alexandria. There's actually additional redevelopment for Fairfax County as well. So it's not just our growth, it's their growth too. Yeah.
Are you able to give an estimate and how long it'll take to replace the pipe in the Lower Holmes Run sewer, the whole thing?
So the question is, how long will it take to replace the pipe? So I don't have, we don't have a construction schedule developed yet, but in terms of, you know, in terms of development being able to move forward, we don't foresee this being in any issue in impeding that. But we do need to work at, we do need to develop a schedule jointly with Alex Renew and the county as to when these improvements need to be made. And how long that will take. I apologize that, yeah, we're at this stage, we don't have a schedule for how long it'll be to replace the sewer. But what we're gonna really be focusing on next is really the timing of when it's needed and the cost sharing.
Well, the reason I ask is because, so this is on the south side of Holmes, right?
Right.
Or also on the south side of the river as opposed to the north side?
So we'll go back to the map.
Yeah.
So right here is the city line, and then here is, it's not labeled very well, but this is Duke Street here.
But the reason I ask is because there's some plans for parkland on the south side of the river in Alexandria, not far from here. You have to put a permeable pad and do different things to it, and I'm wondering, I guess in terms of timing, if those are important.
Okay, so I'm going to, do you mind, because that was a lot, if you can just kind of say that for the reason.
Sure.
Well, what I was asking is that there are some plans for a bit of work on the south side of the river in Alexandria from Van Dorn Street down to approximately the library, close to the library. And there's going to be like a permeable surface path put in there. The park's going to be changed around a little bit. And I was wondering if those two things would be coordinated anyway. I don't know exactly when the city plans to do that building, but if this is somewhere on the horizon.
So yeah, that is something we'll have to coordinate. I don't know off the top of my head what that is, but that's a good question, and agree that work would need to be coordinated. Whether or not this is, you know, 5 years out, 10 years out, this project is really TBD at this point, and the hope is that when we come back in the future, we can give you a sense of when this project may be done. Yes, Mindy.
Is this causing staff to tell any developers to wait to come forward with projects?
So the question is this study? You're saying, is it causing a delay with redevelopment?
Is staff telling developers not to come forward?
Is staff telling developers not to come forward? I do not believe so.
Is this going to hold up any of the projects?
No, it will not be holding up projects. Yes?
I just have a question about your recommendations. How did you kind of come up with the areas? Were those plugged into the model, or?
Yes, so what we did was, you know, the improvements that we looked at a few other possibilities as well. And what we do is we run these different infrastructure improvements through the model, and we look to see, does the sewer have capacity with those improvements in place? So this hasn't been the only thing that was looked at, but when we run it, it confirms that there will be capacity in the pipe. Yes.
For the section that's going to be relined, how close did you get to capacity on that that caused you not to upsize that? I'm a little conservative, and again, I don't know the hydraulics involved, but lining, while it increased capacity a little bit, doesn't seem like it would increase a lot. And so do we have truly room for future growth with just the relining, I guess, is my question.
That's an excellent question, and I didn't get into this, but where the county comes in here, they're both of these sewers exist. They have a diversion chamber called the Down Paris diversion structure, and part of this isn't, even though, and I haven't gotten into this, along with these improvements, we also look at what is the best way to kind of kind of do a flow balance. So there will be some decrease in the amount of flow that goes through this Holmes Run trunk sewer and goes down the Fairfax Holmes Run trunk sewer. So there is kind of this flow balancing that goes with that as well. And that's why you don't need to upsize the Holmes Run trunk sewer, is because you're gonna...
So they're parallel.
Yeah, they're parallel, exactly.
So you can upsize one, it just be like...
Yes, yes. And so what he was asking is that, you know, by doing this flow balancing, you can upsize one pipe, send more flow down it, and just reline the other. As opposed to, you know, if you didn't have this diversion, you might have to replace both. You know, kind of our planned project schedule, you know, our next steps are really looking at the project timing, cost share. You know, we're anticipating starting those discussions, likely in this summer. It's hard to predict how long those will take, but we're still going to be moving forward, even if we don't have all of that worked out, at least, you know, all of the modeling. You know, we're working on a tech memo now and be able to put that out there. So that's kind of our schedule moving forward, and we'll, you know, come back with an update at the next meeting. Okay, so with that, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you very much, Aaron. Hello. My name is David Randall, the Development Division of Planning and Zoning, and I'm here to give you a few updates on the development projects that have been applied for or that we've heard of with the Department of Planning and Zoning. The first I want to tell you about is Cameron Park, which is, of course, just a short distance away at the corner of South Pickett, Cameron Station Boulevard in Edsel, and it has three parts, Building A, the Brandywine senior living facility, and townhouses. Now, the townhouses are, the construction of those is ongoing. The Brandywine senior living facility is open. And for building A, which is a residential commercial mixed use building that's been approved, the pre-construction meeting, which is a required meeting for all development projects in the city, that has already happened, that happened recently, and we expect construction to begin shortly if it hasn't already. The next project is Edsel Shell. There's currently a gas station there at the corner of Edsel and South Van Dorn. And the proposal that's been approved is to demolish the existing station and replace it with new gas pumps, a canopy, and a convenience store car wash building, about 4,100 square feet. And the applicant will be submitting the final site plan mylars to us very soon. We expect that to happen probably in a matter of days. And that is sort of the final step of the city's review process, and we expect construction to happen pretty soon thereafter. The next project we want to update you on is Virginia Paving. And now I've given you an update on this in the past, that we are, and wanted to let you know that we are continuing to review the Virginia Paving special use permit as required under condition number 75 of its most recent approval. And that condition, as you may remember, requires a city council review of the compatibility of the use with the Eisenhower West Small Area Plan and redevelopment in the area generally, and provides for 7 additional years of operation if council decides as a result of that review that the use is not compatible as provided for in the condition. So just a reminder that even if council does decide that the use is not compatible, there is already built into the condition language the concept that it would operate for 7 additional years. Now, the council review and our docketing of that SUP is now targeted for the end of the year. I also want to update you on Green Hill. That's the name for a project that includes 7 properties comprising most of the triangle created by Edsel, South Van Dorn, and South Pickett Street. It does exclude the Modera Tempo building and includes a parcel on the south side of South Pickett. That request is actually for a coordinated development district concept plan that would provide for the density and height for future buildings, as well as a street network and other shared infrastructure. Now, the difference, and I've highlighted this before, but just to review, the difference with this proposal is that it's for a CBD concept plan, or coordinated development district concept plan. And that is actually a more general approval for, say, all those properties in certain neighborhood that would be created or could be created, as opposed to what some of you know as development special use permits, which would still be required for each individual building that would be a part of that CDD if approved. The anticipated uses in that CDD are multifamily residential, a little bit of office, some retail, and institutional uses, and a potential maximum of 2.9 million square feet. The CDD plan, I already mentioned that, does include approval of individual buildings. We have provided comments to the applicant, that was a couple months ago, for the concept two. And we are now working with the applicant regarding the timeline for docketing the case, but we don't expect that to happen for many more months. But we will provide, there will be additional outreach both from staff and the applicant with the community prior to any docketing with the Planning Commission or City Council. One more for you is the Beau U.S. Public Storage Project, and that is actually a new update compared to the last time I provided you with an update. This is a new project, and the site is 880 South Pickett Street at the corner of Pickett and Burnside Place, where the Beau U.S. property is now located. The proposal before the city is for a six-story self-storage building of about 360,000 square feet, and the applicant is also proposing ground-level retail or maker space fronting South Pickett. In addition, the applicant is proposing a future multifamily building to the south side of the self-storage building, as well as open space along Backlick Run. And in addition to that, at a grid of new streets. Now, those last items that I mentioned are not being requested as part of the DSUP, but we believe that they will be as part of a new CDD. The applicant has not requested that yet, but we anticipate that that's the direction that the project will be going. We have almost completed our review of the concept two, and we're about to send the applicant comments very soon. And we anticipate a potential hearing date before the Planning Commission and City Council at the end of the year. A few additional items I wanted to share with you. We've also spoken with representatives about the development potential for a property at 550 South Pickett Street, which is a triangular piece of land, vacant land, near the intersection of Edsel, Cameron Station Boulevard, and South Pickett Street, just a short distance away. And the city, we've not received any submissions for that proposal just yet. We also understand that the Vulcan property on South Van Dorn or off of South Van Dorn has been sold. And if we hear anything about, if we receive a proposal for redevelopment of that property, we will definitely update the group. Those are all the updates that I have for everyone. Are there any questions? Yes.
Why is Retail not coming forward if they're through with the first three concepts?
So we have given them.
Why is it being pushed back till next year?
So the question was about the Green Hill proposal, and we have provided comments on the concept two to the applicant. We are in discussions with them right now about what the next proposal would be, whether it would be a concept three or completeness. We are also reviewing. We have shared with them a preliminary time frame. And we are in the process of, we've heard from them that they are concerned about that potential time frame, that they might like to go a little sooner. So we're in the process of talking about that right now. And we've been in touch with the applicant. I just emailed Mary Catherine Gibbs today. Are there any other questions? Yes.
Do you have any updates on the multimodal. So
the question was, are there any updates on the multimodal bridge? And I can say that very generally, I know that the process is ongoing for a 10% design study. Perhaps someone from neighborhood planning could provide a little bit more, or Ramiro, would you like to? Yeah, Ramiro from Tess.
My name is Good evening, my name is Ramiro Rios, and I work for the Department of Transportation and Environmental Services. I'm a principal planner. And last time that we talked about the Eisenhower West landmark Van Dorn infrastructure plan, we selected the preferred alignment for that bridge. according to what Norfolk Southern had proposed as a preferred alignment. And we were moving forward with a 10% design. We have now moved in, our consultants are working on the 10% design. We have not made enough progress to complete that, that 10% design, but we are in the process of completing it. We're also working on the, you know, different other parts of the that project, which include the Farrington Connector, the straightening of Eisenhower Avenue, actually to meet the bridge, and also work that we're doing to connect Metro Road back to the multimodal bridge. So, you know, just there's no major updates other than we're still working on the 10% design for all those components.
Thank you. Any other development update questions? Okay, well, okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, I think that wraps everything up for tonight. So the next AG meeting is actually in September. We do not have a date selected right now or a location. Thank you very much for enduring this space and our equipment malfunctions tonight, but hopefully next time we will have a better presentation set up. So with that, I will be in contact with the AG and the public with a new date for September. And so does anyone have any other questions before we wrap up tonight? Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.